You're listening to Beyond Bourbon Street, an insider's guide to New Orleans. Beyond Bourbon Street is the podcast where we explore the food, music, culture, places, and people that make New Orleans unique. Whether you are planning a trip, living in New Orleans, or simply wanting a taste of the Crescent City from wherever you are, you've come to the right place. And now, your host, Mark Bologna.
Hey y'all, this is Mark. Thanks for tuning in. I hope you enjoyed the last show about the history of the po' boy. It was a lot of fun to interview my dad, and I sincerely appreciate all the emails and texts. If you missed it, go back and check it out. I want to take a moment now and say thanks to all of you who have sent me a note or left a review. We're up to 46 reviews on iTunes now, including FitJunkie1011, BeachBum74, Nevermind515, History Goes Bump. Thanks, and by the way, they have a fun podcast. Check it out. BV262, Joel Bogus, and Life Current, who writes, Mr. Bologna has done the city of New Orleans an awesome service by sharing his wealth of knowledge and locating inspiring personalities to give a flavorful presentation of one of the United States' hidden cultural gems, New Orleans. I love it. Thank you, Mark. Thanks, Life Current, and to all of you for these reviews. If you leave a review, I'll definitely mention it on an episode. This really helps attract more listeners, and it also helps me to know I'm providing you with something you enjoy, which is the real reason I'm doing this, to entertain, to teach, and to help you get the most out of your time in this wonderful place I get to call home. Now, on to today's show. In this episode, we'll talk about St. Patrick's Day in New Orleans. Of course, there are parades and block parties. This is New Orleans, after all. But as you'll discover, the real story is the impact of the Irish on New Orleans. In government, architecture, banking, the Port of New Orleans, and the New Basin Canal, among other things. We'll explore this history, the parades, the bars, and more. So let's get started. The earliest celebrations of St. Patrick's Day in the United States date back to the 18th century. Not surprisingly, the first recorded observance was held in Boston in 1737. New York and Philadelphia also held celebrations in the mid to late 1700s. And the city of Savannah got into the act as well in the early 19th century and still holds one of the largest celebrations in the country. In New Orleans, the first reported celebration goes back to 1806, just 3 years after the Louisiana Purchase. That year, a select group of citizens gathered to celebrate the Feast of St. Patrick with a dinner and a series of toasts. Some of these toasts will help shed light on why the Irish had come to New Orleans. For instance, they toasted the armies that fight for the independence of their country, the commerce of the United States, the venerable clergy throughout the continent of America, the King of Spain, and the three C's of Louisiana, cane, cotton, and corn. Our discussion today will help frame the importance of these things, but let's start with the modern celebrations and work our way backwards. The St. Patrick's celebrations in New Orleans generally span about 10 days, starting the weekend before March 17th and going through the weekend after. The festivities include block parties and multiple parades. The season traditionally kicks off the Friday evening before St. Patrick's Day with the annual Jim Monahan French Quarter Parade. The parade begins and ends at Molly's at the Market in the French Quarter, located at 1107 Decatur Street. Monahan was a legend in the quarter, where he owned a slew of watering holes, including Molly's and Aaron Rose. And as an aside, we discussed Killer Po' Boys, the pop-up place at Aaron Rose, in the previous episode. Known for his ebullient personality, Jim was unofficially the mayor of the French Quarter. He certainly knew everyone. And while Monahan passed away in 2001, his spirit lives on through his family, the people he worked with in the bars, and the patrons. The parade bearing his name has been around for more than 30 years, and is equal parts parade and pub crawl. These days, his son, Jim Monahan Jr., his grandson, Trey, and his fourth and last wife ensure the festivities keep going. They have plenty of help, I might add. By the way, this last wife, Liz Scott Monahan, is a bit of a character in her own right. She's a writer who writes under the pen name Modine Gunch. You can check out her book, Never Clean Your House During Hurricane Season, on Amazon. She also wrote a wonderful summation of Jim's funeral, which you can find on the Aaron Rose website, and I'll link to it in the show notes. Okay, back to the parade. Per tradition, the parade is led by the Storyville Stompers Brass Band. Following the Stompers are a procession of carriages with marching groups and bands interspersed among them. Aboard the carriages are more than 150 riders wearing formal wear for the men and green gowns for the ladies. As they parade through the French Quarter, they toss Irish-themed throws while enjoying a drink or two, or perhaps three or four. The whole motley thing heads down Decatur towards Canal Street. It turns up at Bienville to Dauphine, comes back down Conti where it passes Aaron Rose, and turns onto Bourbon Street. Bourbon to Governor Nichols, then back to Decatur. As you know, this podcast is called Beyond Bourbon Street, but this is one of those occasions where Bourbon Street is filled with as many locals as visitors, and it's definitely worth checking out. Before, during, and after, you can duck into your favorite Irish bar and hoist a pint or two. And of course, since this is New Orleans, you can spill back out into the street and bring your drink with you. By the way, Molly's is a great bar, even when you're not celebrating St. Patrick's Day. It's a bit removed from the craziness of Bourbon Street, and it's popular among French Quarter residents and regulars, in addition to those visiting the city. On the Saturday before St. Patrick's Day is the Irish Channel Parade. Just before the parade, a Catholic Mass is celebrated at St. Mary's Assumption Church on Constance Street. Following Mass, the 1,400-member parade starts at 1 p.m. at the corner of Chapitulis and Napoleon, right outside Tipitina's. It heads up Napoleon to Magazine, where it turns right and heads downriver. At Jackson Avenue, the parade turns right towards the river and goes until it reaches Chapitulis again, where it disbands. One note, if you listen to this in 2016, the route has changed this year due to construction. As a result, it doesn't go down St. Charles Avenue as it has in past years. Don't be the guy standing out there wondering where everyone else is. In addition to Mardi Gras-style floats carrying riders, this event features hundreds of tuxedo-clad men marching and handing out paper flowers in exchange for a kiss on the cheek from the ladies along the route. One other note about the parade. In addition to the beads and trinkets common in New Orleans parades, revelers can expect to catch cabbage, carrots, potatoes, and other vegetables too, as well as moon pies. The idea here is to toss the ingredients that you need to make a traditional Irish meal. Well, except for the moon pies. But everyone needs dessert, or at least a snack while you're watching the parade, right? On both the Saturday before St. Patrick's Day, as well as on St. Patrick's Day itself, head to the Irish Channel for the block parties. Tracy's, at the corner of Magazine and 3rd Street, has one end of the affair. And a block down 3rd Street, at the corner of Constance, you'll find Parasols. Both offer up corned beef and cabbage, plenty of green beer, and a host of other drinks and food. Green Jello shots are also particularly popular. The crowds fill up Constance Street with revelers and tend to spill over into the neighboring streets as well. The party starts early in the morning and continues until 8 or 9 in the evening. Do yourself a favor, though, and don't try to drive anywhere close to this event. Think about it. You're likely going there to drink, and you're headed to an area where most everybody's drinking. This is true on Saturday as well as on St. Patrick's Day, but particularly so when St. Paddy's Day is on a weekday. My thought process here is you have the usual traffic in that area, combined with people sneaking out of work to head over to the party, plus all the people in the street already imbibing. If you heed my advice, take the St. Charles streetcar and hop off near Washington Avenue and walk the 5 short blocks to Magazine. It's not the greatest area for a walk, but on St. Patrick's Day and the Saturday before, you won't be alone. These are also prime events for taking a taxi or an Uber or more recently even a Lyft. Just watch the surge pricing on Uber. If you do drive, I would suggest parking upriver of Washington Avenue, somewhere between St. Charles and Britannia. But again, I don't think it's the best idea to drive. Here's another insider tip. Parasols and Tracy's will be quickly overrun. They have outside bars set up as well as porta potties. But to cover your beverage needs, consider bringing an ice chest or a cooler backpack. And a public service announcement here. As we've discussed in the Mardi Gras episode, please don't pee in public. It's the easiest way to get arrested in New Orleans. Not to mention, the Irish Channel is a neighborhood. People live here, and in fairly close quarters, no less. They don't need you watering their front steps or alleyways. So definitely go and have a good time, but just pay mind to those couple things. On Sunday before St. Patrick's Day is the parade in Metairie, a nearby suburb of New Orleans. This parade, like the one in New Orleans the day before, features men in formal wear marching down the street and handing out paper flowers in exchange for a kiss. It, too, has riders on Mardi Gras-style floats, tossing beads and trinkets, as well as cabbage and other vegetables. Metairie parades are not my favorite. I prefer to be in the city, but this one is an exception because of its location. This parade spends much of its time on Metairie Road, a beautiful tree-lined street in Old Metairie. It's very family-oriented, lots of places to eat, and something a little different from downtown. And unlike carnival season, where Metairie parades compete with New Orleans, this is the only parade on Sunday. On St. Patrick's Day itself, you get a parade in the French Quarter and the block parties in the Irish Channel, even when St. Patrick's Day falls during the work week. In fact, I think those celebrations in New Orleans are the most fun. When St. Patrick's Day falls on a weekday, you'll notice businessmen slipping out of their offices in the CBD by mid-morning and showing up on Constance Street in work attire, eager to join the party. By early afternoon, that area will be a sea of humanity, enjoying the music, the beer, the jello shots, and just the festivities. There's something about a party during the workday in New Orleans that just feels right. The only other time of year that feels quite the same to me is Jazz Fest, but we'll save that for a future episode. The parade on St. Patrick's Day is held by the Downtown Irish Club. Organized in 1976, the parade starts at 6 p.m. in the Bywater at Bud Rip's Bar. The procession goes through the Marigny and into the French Quarter, spending time on Royal and Decatur Streets before disbanding at the corner of Bourbon and Orleans. This parade is part marching club, part homemade floats, part second line. The parade itself stops at several bars along the route, making it a sort of combo parade, moving block party, and pub crawl. Here's an additional bit of history I love about this one. Its roots are tied to Mardi Gras, the Irish Channel, a dispute, and the legendary Jim Monahan, whom we discussed earlier. According to the club website, Jim and Eddie Griffin were hanging out together on Mardi Gras morning in 1976. While waiting for Pete Fountain, the clarinetist, to come by with his half-fast marching club, the two started talking about the need for a downtown St. Patrick's Day parade. Both men were members of the Irish Channel Marching Club, and both were upset at not having the opportunity to be Grand Marshal, something about residency requirements. In any event, they held a couple meetings with several other bar owners, and the club was formed. The organization was created, and the rest is history. One other note about the parades held in New Orleans. They all have practice parades. Really, just an opportunity for the men who march to get together and drink beer ahead of the actual event. Only in New Orleans, right? A parade to practice parading. Here's a little bit of Lagniappe, too, while we're at it. There are also combination Italian-American parades held on the weekend nearest St. Joseph's Day, which is March 19th. These again feature men in tuxedos marching or dancing down the streets, exchanging the paper flowers for kisses. I come from an Italian family, Sicilian, actually, and we'll do a separate episode about this population. Additionally, if you listened to the earlier episode about Carnival, all the way past the closing music, you heard a little about the Mardi Gras Indians. Besides parading on Mardi Gras, the Indians come together again on Super Sunday, the Sunday after St. Joseph's Day. Again, look for a future episode about the Indians. For today's show, I really wanted to focus on the Irish, not only the parades, but their impact on New Orleans. Why is St. Patrick's Day such a big deal in New Orleans? I guess the easy answer would be because we love a party here in the Big Easy, and we have the whole Mardi Gras infrastructure. The floats, the beads, everyone's used to it and all that. The problem is, that's too simple, and it's simply not correct. To get at the heart of why we love St. Patrick's Day, we need to go back a ways. We need to explore the history of the Irish in New Orleans and their impact on New Orleans. To frame this up, let's start with a very brief recap of the history of New Orleans. Really quick. Ready? In 1718, Bienville establishes the city we know today as New Orleans. The original footprint of that city is the French Quarter. As you already know, we were under French rule at that time. In 1763, New Orleans is transferred from France to Spain as a secret provision of the 1762 Treaty of Fontainebleau. Incidentally, the treaty actually transferred the French territory west of the Mississippi, plus New Orleans. I'd like to think this is because even back then, people couldn't quite figure us out, since a portion of the city was, and still is, across the river from the French Quarter. The Spanish colonial period lasted from 1763 until 1800, when the French resumed ownership, but they didn't really take back governance. In 1803, of course, Napoleon sold Louisiana to the United States. Why is all this important to a discussion of the Irish in New Orleans? Well, I'm glad you asked. The answer is Catholicism. New Orleans has always been home to a large Catholic population as a result of our French and Spanish history, since, of course, both these countries were, and still are, largely Catholic. The first Irish immigrants to come to New Orleans arrived during the Spanish colonial period. During this time, people left Ireland largely because of political reasons, and specifically to avoid English persecution. They generally headed to France or Spain to escape English domination and to practice their Catholic faith. In many instances, they pursued one of two paths. They joined the military of Spain or France, or they were merchants or businessmen of some sort. For similar reasons, some of these Irish citizens were attracted to New Orleans. Here they found a Catholic community and a shared dislike of the English. Additionally, there were plenty of opportunities in the New World. In fact, the second governor of Louisiana during the Spanish colonial period was an Irishman who rose to the rank of general in the Spanish army, General Alejandro O'Reilly. O'Reilly had left Ireland and joined the Spanish army so he could serve under a Catholic monarch. He arrived in New Orleans in 1769, and he was but one of many who chose a similar path. In general, the immigrants who made it to New Orleans during this time were most often middle class and not poor, given the high cost of passage. This group also integrated fairly easily into New Orleans society. Immigrants were doctors, lawyers, bankers, printers, and journalists. They frequently married into existing families here and did not have an ethnic enclave of their own. In the early to mid-1800s, a second, much larger wave of Irish immigrants came to New Orleans. Looking to escape the famine in their homeland, many found passage on the cotton ships. These ships left from New Orleans and traveled to Liverpool, where they dropped off their bales of cotton. In need of ballast for the return voyage, they were often filled with immigrants, many of Irish background, looking for an inexpensive, though not particularly pleasant, transport back to the New World. Why would Irish immigrants come to New Orleans? For one, it was and largely still is a Catholic city, as I mentioned earlier. Additionally, in the 1800s, New Orleans offered a wealth of job opportunities. While many were centered around the port, New Orleans was a commercial center in general. The Mississippi River also offered another attraction beyond the transport of goods. It was a relatively easy means of travel into the interior of the country, or the reverse. Compared to places like New York and Boston, this was a competitive advantage enjoyed by New Orleans. This wave of immigration also coincided with the rise of cotton as a major commodity and the appearance of river traffic on the mighty Mississippi River. To put this in some context, the first steamboat arrived in New Orleans in 1812. It was, in fact, called the New Orleans. It was the beginning of a new era of prosperity in the city. In the 1810s, there were about 20 boats plying the trade waters of the river. By the 1830s, there were 1,200, and by the 1850s, 30,000. By this time, New Orleans was the second largest port in the United States and the fourth largest and busiest in the world. New Orleans at this time had the largest population of Irish immigrants in the American South. In fact, by 1850, one in every five New Orleanians were from Ireland. While we often think of New Orleans as a French and a Spanish city, in the mid-1800s, the Irish could certainly claim it as theirs. What did all these Irish immigrants do? How were they employed? Well, it's true that Irish immigrants supplied much of the workforce used to dig the New Basin Canal, which we'll talk about in a moment. They were not all laborers, as history sometimes suggests. In the 1850 census in New Orleans, half of all Irishmen listed occupations other than common laborer, crossing all common professions of the time, including doctors and lawyers. As in other American cities, the Irish did work in and dominate the professions surrounding the port. And as I mentioned a minute ago, New Orleans at that time was one of the largest ports in both the United States and the world. Needless to say, there was plenty of work. During the Civil War, many of the Irish joined the Confederate cause. Their reasons were varied, of course, but I'll mention a few of them here. In some cases, the Irish immigrants who had fled British repression saw the Union or the North as another version of the British. That is, the North was trying to impose their rule and way of life on the South. Another issue was economic. If the slaves were freed, it would undoubtedly increase the competition for jobs in New Orleans and all of the South. Finally, many Irish had only come to New Orleans in the last decade or two. Fighting for the cause would have been seen as patriotic and undoubtedly would have helped improve the Irishmen's standings among the community they had fought so hard to join and become a part of. After the Civil War, life was hard in New Orleans. Like much of the South, the economy didn't rebound quickly, if at all. As a result, jobs were not as plentiful, and therefore immigration slowed considerably. Now that we know a little bit about the immigration of the Irish to New Orleans, we should talk about where they settled. The first Irish immigrants integrated into New Orleans life. They married into other cultures and were relatively small in numbers. As such, there were no ethnic enclaves of Irish or really any other ethnicities. This changed after the Louisiana Purchase. Shortly after the purchase, Americans came to the city, and almost immediately, they wanted an area of New Orleans to themselves and away from the Creoles, the French, and the Spanish who dominated the original confines in New Orleans, the French Quarter. They established themselves in the Faubourg Saint-Marie, today's central business district, and gradually along the river to the areas we know today as the Garden District and eventually uptown New Orleans. This was the situation when the famine Irish arrived here, and the Irish followed more or less the same path along the river and away from the French Quarter. The largest concentration of Irish immigrants in New Orleans during this period settled into an area known as the Irish Channel. At the time, the Irish Channel was outside the city limits, in an area known as Lafayette City. This is not the Lafayette we know today in southwestern Louisiana. Rather, this was a city that encompassed parts of the present-day Garden District and the Irish Channel. It was incorporated into New Orleans in 1852. The borders of the Irish Channel, like so much about New Orleans, are a little fuzzy depending on who you ask and what time period you're referring to. At various times, the Irish Channel covered the area from Chapultepec to Felicity on the east, and as far uptown as Alien Street to the west, generally bounded by Magazine to the north. Sometimes it was defined much more narrowly, and oddly, the area on the National Register of Historic Places, as well as the New Orleans Historic District, the boundaries exclude Adele Street, which is odd, since there seems to be little argument that Adele Street was the center of the channel, if not geographically, at least in practical terms. In any case, the Irish Channel runs along the river to Magazine Street from south to north, while its east and west borders are a little less clear. At least during the St. Patrick's Day celebrations, I'd argue the center is the block of First Street bounded by Tracy's and Parasol's. Back in the 19th century, it would have included Adele Street and likely the area where Jackson Avenue is today. In any event, at the heart of the Irish community in New Orleans were its churches. They were not only places of worship and gathering spots, but they also functioned as banks for the immigrants who were distrustful of traditional banks. We talked earlier about how New Orleans has always been a Catholic city, yet amazingly, for its first 100 years, there was only a single Catholic church, the St. Louis Cathedral, in the heart of the French Quarter. The second Catholic church in the city was St. Patrick's, which was built at the behest of the fast-growing population of immigrants from Ireland who wanted their own place of worship. Established in 1833, the first building was a small wooden structure. In 1834, work began on the structure you can visit today on Camp Street in the Central Business District. Again, the area was known as the Faubourg Saint-Marie and as the American Sector. In fact, at the World War II Museum nearby, there's a restaurant called the American Sector. I walked by St. Patrick's just the other day while I was working on this episode, and I heard the church bells ringing. It was easy to envision what the area might have been like at that time. Let's try to do that now. New Orleans in the mid-19th century was bustling. Literally thousands of sailing ships visited the port, in addition to flatboats, ferries, tugs, and barges. This created tremendous opportunity for the Irish looking to escape the dire conditions of their homeland. From St. Patrick's, you can hear the noise and the call of the steamboats. The area is busy with businessmen and laborers alike. You are between the old and the new basin canals, connectors to the lake and the Gulf of Mexico beyond. Activity surrounds you. The air is likely thick with smoke, heat, and humidity. Cotton, molasses, and other goods are unloaded from the ships as soon as they dock against the levees. The new New Orleanians, including the Irish, play a large part in this trade. At the same time, New Orleans was not the easiest place to be. Few, if any, of the roads were paved. New Orleans then, as it is today, doesn't have a natural drainage system. Today, of course, excess water is pumped out of the city. But back then, water, sewage, trash, all that was left to rot in many cases in warm, humid conditions. Often, just outside the buildings where people lived. Even by 1870, only 5% of the city's roads were paved. All of this created conditions ripe for disease, particularly yellow fever, as well as cholera and typhus. The immigrant populations were most susceptible to these epidemics and suffered greatly. In her book, The Irish in New Orleans, Laura Kelly explains that between 1800 and 1900, yellow fever, commonly known as Yellow Jack, struck the city in 67 summers. In 1853 alone, 29,000 people contracted yellow fever, and more than 8,500 died from it, including 1 in 5 Irish. So, while New Orleans was a place of great opportunity, it was also a difficult place to be. All this helps to reinforce the importance to the Irish and of other populations of having a community of their own. St. Alphonsus Parish was formed in 1849 in an area we now know as the Irish Channel. a church of the same name as the parish was completed nearly a decade later. Just across the street and completed in the same general time period was St. Mary's, a Catholic church which catered to another immigrant group, the German population. Both were run by the religious order known as the Redemptorists. As if that wasn't enough, the Redemptorists also ran a third church in the parish, just a couple blocks away, named Bon Secours, that catered to the French. Today, only St. Mary's operates as a church. Bon Secours is gone. It was torn down in the early 20th century after enduring a hurricane and later a fire. St. Alphonsus doesn't hold a regular mass these days, but it's used for special occasions and private events. It's now known as the St. Alphonsus Art and Cultural Center. It's open on Tuesdays, Thursdays, and Saturdays each week from 10 to 12. As I mentioned a moment ago, St. Mary's is literally across the street, though its main entrance faces Josephine Street. It's interesting to walk this area. On the one hand, it's not the best or safest spot in the city, but on the other, there is a lot of activity. As you walk down Constance Street, you realize how big these two churches are. It strikes me as odd that two really large churches of the same denomination were built literally across the street from each other, but of course they were serving different populations. It gives you some sense of how large those populations were, that there was enough of a demand for two large churches. The neighborhood is dense, the streets are narrow, and the structures are all in close confines, though early pictures show quite a bit of land around these churches. In fact, there was a five-block area here known as Ecclesiastical Square. It included the churches, as well as nine schools, some stables, a convent, a residence for the priests, and an orphanage, as well as other support buildings. While the focus of today's show is the Irish, St. Mary's is so intertwined with the neighborhood and the parish, it's worth talking about for a minute. Again, it was run by the Redemptorists. Most noteworthy among these priests was Father Francis Xavier Silos, a German priest who was particularly known for his devotion to the community, even during the yellow fever and cholera epidemic. Father Silos was only in New Orleans for about 2 years before he too succumbed to yellow fever. Even so, he's revered in the Catholic community in New Orleans today, and there's a shrine to him at St. Mary's where he's buried. Beyond the churches I've already mentioned, there were also St. Joseph's on Tulane Avenue, St. John the Baptist, Saints Peter and Paul, and St. Teresa's. Most were built over a relatively short period of time and in response to the rapidly growing Irish population in the mid-19th century. Again, at that time, nearly 20% of the city's residents were Irish. Their impact on church and education lives on today. Not far from my home is a Notre Dame seminary on Carrollton Avenue. It was established under the leadership of Archbishop John William Shaw, the 8th Archbishop of New Orleans, and the son of Irish immigrants. Just behind the seminary is the current location of the St. Mary's Dominican School for Girls, which was founded in 1861. Even as an Italian kid growing up in the city, our parish was served by a string of Irish priests. It was Father Harry Bugler who convinced me to become an altar boy, though my favorite story about Father Harry involved my younger brother, Matthew. My parents were faithful about taking all of us to Mass each Sunday, and even though my brother was too young to receive communion, he'd walk up to the altar to receive a blessing at my mother's urging. I remember one Sunday, he walked up. Father Harry put his hand on Matthew's head, and as loudly as he could, Matt shouted, "If you do that one more time, I'm going to kick you in the shin." Oh well, Father Harry is still a family friend today, so I guess it worked out. What I mostly wanted to accomplish here was to show you the influence of the Irish on the Catholic community in New Orleans. Over a relatively short period of time, many churches were constructed to serve the population. The churches that survive today are beautiful and important parts of the religious history of New Orleans. So far, we've talked about immigration, about where the Irish settled in the city, and about their impact on the Catholic community in New Orleans. Earlier, I mentioned the fact that while the Irish immigrants were employed across many professions, nearly one half of the famine Irish were employed as laborers. Perhaps their most famous work in New Orleans in this regard was the building of the New Basin Canal. Let's talk about the canal now. The New Orleans Canal and Banking Company was incorporated in 1831. Its purpose was to dig a canal that would connect Lake Pontchartrain with the American sector of the city. It would be in direct competition with the Carondelet Canal, also known as the Old Basin Canal, which connected the lake with the French Quarter. That canal had a monopoly at the time on the lucrative business of transporting goods from the lake to the city. It also gets back to the tension I mentioned earlier between the Creoles and the Americans in New Orleans. Work on the new Basin Canal began in 1832, and it was completed in 1838. It was 60 feet wide and 3.17 miles long with a 6-foot draft. It was later widened to 100 feet wide and 12 feet deep with a shell road alongside it. This was difficult work in tough conditions. At that time, the land between the lake and the American sector was a swamp, infested with snakes and alligators. To give you a sense of how tough it was, Irish immigrants were used to dig the canal because slaves were considered too valuable for this type of work in the swamps in New Orleans. Many Irish laborers died due to the difficult conditions, as well as cholera and possibly yellow fever. The count of how many died during the construction of the canal varies widely, from several hundred to as many as 30,000. Historian Laura Kelly theorizes the number was probably on the lower end by comparing the number of workers needed to construct a much larger canal in Philadelphia. It's also possible that accounts of the effects on the workers has been mixed historically with the impact of citywide epidemics in roughly the same time period. Nonetheless, the cost in human lives was significant and disproportionately impacted the Irish, who were trying to make a better life for their families. The canal did accomplish its goal. It became an important connection point and source of commerce, connecting the lake to the American sector, and within a couple years, it easily outpaced the commerce on the old Basin Canal. The lake was and still is important because, really, it's not a lake at all. Rather, it's an estuary that ultimately connects the city with the Gulf of Mexico. For all of its impact and the huge cost in money and lives, though, the canal was filled in the 1950s. If you wanted to trace the route of the new Basin Canal today, you'd start out at Lake Pontchartrain near the lighthouse. The only remaining portion of the actual canal is the first part, about 3/4 of a mile long. There are a couple restaurants, Brisby's and the Blue Crab, that sit along the canal. It then followed the path of what today is Pontchartrain Boulevard and the Pontchartrain Expressway. Just past Robert E. Lee Boulevard, there are some houses, then a wide green space along Pontchartrain Boulevard. That is the site of the new Basin Canal. In fact, you can find a Celtic cross erected as a monument to the Irish immigrants who dug the canal. Follow the Pontchartrain Expressway straight downtown to the Superdome. The new Basin Canal terminated about where the Amtrak station is today. Again, Irish worked in nearly all professions, but the digging of the new Basin Canal is perhaps the most famous project in New Orleans associated with the Irish immigrants of the early to mid-1800s. The Irish also have a significant part in the banking and architecture of New Orleans. This leads me to the Hibernia Bank and Trust Company. Founded in 1870, the men who organized the bank chose as its name the Latin name of Ireland given to us by the Romans, Hibernia. Hibernia Bank existed until it was purchased by Capital One in 2005. A remnant of Hibernia Bank can still be found in the skyline of the Central Business District. Look for the bank tower, or specifically the White Tower atop 812 Gravier Street. This was the home of Hibernia Bank from 1921 until its purchase in 2005. At one point, the tower actually served as a beacon for ships on the Mississippi River. At the time of its acquisition, Hibernia was the oldest and largest bank in Louisiana. Throughout my life, the lights in the tower reflected the seasons of New Orleans: red and green at Christmas, purple, green, and gold at Mardi Gras. Today, the building has been redeveloped as commercial and residential space, but the white tower with its lights remain. It's a reminder of the past to those who are aware of it. Another of the lasting impacts of the Irish immigrants is on the architecture in New Orleans. Certainly their impact is seen and felt in the churches from that period that endure today. However, I want to talk about one architect in particular, James Gallagher, better known in the city today as James Gallier. Gallagher came to New Orleans in 1834 when he adopted the French surname Gallier. He completed work on St. Patrick's after the original architects failed to complete the project. He also designed Gallier Hall, which was the New Orleans City Hall from 1853 until the 1950s. Today, Gallier Hall is undergoing a major restoration project. It sits on St. Charles Avenue, directly across from Lafayette Square. During Mardi Gras, the mayor of New Orleans greets the kings of the carnival organizations when their parades pass in front of Gallier Hall. In fact, in 1884, the Mystic Crew of Comus carnival organization chose the history of Ireland as its theme, no doubt because the captain of the crew at that time was Irish, Mr. Ambrose McGinnis, Jr. Today, you can visit the home of Gallier's son, James Gallier, Jr., who is also a noted architect. The Gallier House is in the French Quarter on Royal Street. It's been restored in the style of the 1850s and is fully furnished with period furnishings. The grounds also include a carriageway, a courtyard garden, and slave quarters. It's definitely worth checking out, and it's something I'll mention in an upcoming show about the French Quarter Festival. One more person I wanted to talk about, Margaret Horary. Margaret arrived in New Orleans in 1835 with her husband. Soon after, she gave birth to their daughter. However, within a year, both her husband and her child had died. Soon, Margaret found herself working at the St. Charles Hotel in the American sector. Incidentally, the St. Charles was designed by James Gallier. In any event, Margaret worked hard and both relied upon and gave as much as she could to the Catholic Church. The Sisters of Charity provided Margaret with a place to live at their orphanage, and in return she saved her money and purchased a couple dairy cows with the intent of providing milk to the orphans. Margaret turned out to have quite a knack for business. She sold the extra milk via a milk cart and over time grew the business. Within just a couple years, she had 40 cows. All along, she continued to do all she could to help the nuns and the kids, giving them most of her earnings. At one point, she took over a bakery as well. She had been loaning them funds and eventually found herself as the majority owner. With no experience in that business, she grew the bakery into a major operation and eventually the largest bakery in the United States. Through it all, Margaret stayed focused on helping orphans. She sold bread at cost to local orphanages and gave away bread to anyone in need. When Margaret died in 1882, she left $13,000 to 6 orphanages and 2 asylums for widows. That's over $300,000 in today's dollars. She also left a little over $50,000, or $1.2 million in today's dollars, to the Sisters of Charity. Incredible considering this Irish woman found herself widowed and grieving the loss of a child in a new country at the age of 23, illiterate and with no business experience. Today, Margaret is honored in New Orleans in a small park called Margaret Place. The park is near the site of the orphanage where she lived, as well as St. Teresa of Avila Church. The park is located just down from the American sector in the back of the Lower Garden District. Her park is between Britannia and Camp Streets, where she sits alongside one of the many orphans she helped. Let's jump back to modern-day New Orleans, and specifically the Irish Channel. The Irish Channel went through a long period of decline in the mid to late 20th century. The St. Thomas housing development was completed in 1941, and demand for these units was high at the time, yet they were also considered a slum by many due to the close living quarters. In the 1960s, with the passage of desegregation, the neighborhood became more diverse. The area was hit hard, first by the drug trade, and then the oil bust over the next couple of decades. As a result, the Irish Channel lost one-third of its population between 1970 and 1990. At the same time, the Redemptorists began to sell off the furnishings from St. Alphonsus. However, lately, things have started to change once again in the Irish Channel. Like much of New Orleans, this area has enjoyed a renaissance of sorts. People have moved back to the area, and housing prices have risen considerably. It continues to be a very diverse area, but it's even more of a true blend of different cultures and ethnicities than any time I can remember in my life. Magazine Street, in particular, is a booming area, complete with bars, restaurants, and boutiques. And of course, during the St. Patrick's Day celebrations, the Irish Channel is once again the center of the Irish-American community of New Orleans. There are terrific Irish pubs throughout the city. In the French Quarter are the aforementioned Molly's and Aaron Rose, among others. Heck, I haven't even mentioned Pat O'Brien's. The Mid-City neighborhood has Finn McCool's, a wonderful pub owned and run by two of the nicest people you'll ever meet, Stephen and Pauline Patterson, who also happen to be from Belfast. They also have a place on Tulane Avenue called Trio. I have to say, I would never have thought of that area as a destination before Trio. They've done a great job. Good drinks, good beer, surprising food, and a wonderful space, including an art gallery. Don't be turned off by the neighborhood. This is a great place to spend an evening. In the Garden District on St. Charles Avenue is the Irish House. Owned by Chef Matt Murphy, it offers a traditional Irish menu alongside dishes that definitely reflect the food and the culture of New Orleans. The Irish House is billed as an Irish gastropub, and it lives up to it. As you would expect, they also offer Irish beers and whiskey. If you're looking for an upscale Irish place, though, complete with great food and drinks, this is it. Matt Murphy and the Irish House brings me to one last area of Irish influence in New Orleans I want to mention, the food. As you know, New Orleans is home to some of the best food in the country. And when you think of New Orleans food, you usually think and hear about the French influence and the Cajun and Creole styles of cooking. You also think about the seafood we love and are known for. What you might not realize is the Irish impact. We have our own food royalty in New Orleans, and chief among them are the Brennans, who, as you might have guessed, have Irish ancestors. Today, there's more than a dozen restaurants who have some member of the Brennan family tree at its helm. Matt Murphy of the Irish House is one of the alumni of the Commander's Palace Kitchen, one of the Brennan's flagship restaurants. Not bad, considering Paul Prudhomme, Emeril Lagasse, Jamie Shannon, and a host of others have come through that same kitchen. We've already mentioned Tracy's and Parasol's in the Irish Channel. Just down Magazine is Mahoney's Po' Boys, and further upriver is one of my wife's favorite spots, Clancy's. This neighborhood bistro is hard to find, but definitely worth the effort. These are just a smattering of the restaurants throughout the city with a tie to the Irish community. So there you have it. At first glance, the St. Patrick's Day celebrations in New Orleans appear to be simply another opportunity to do what we do, celebrate in public. But when you dig a bit, you find the real reason for the celebration, to honor the history and the significant and lasting impact of the Irish in New Orleans, in all aspects of the city. You also might notice it in a way you can't quite place, the accent. No, not the Cajun accent, but the slightly Brooklyn-esque accent that's common here. The dropping of the R's and the absence of the H's. You know, Mark, go get the car so we can drive to Houston. That one. While some Irish immigrants came directly to New Orleans from Europe, others started out on the East Coast and migrated here over time. All right, I owe a special thanks to several sources for today's show. First, to one of our listeners, Blackbird Mike, who suggested the topic for this episode. Mike is a native Chicagoan who lives in North Carolina and visits New Orleans frequently. Thanks, Mike. Hopefully, by the time you listen to this, we'll have met and had a beer together. A lot of the research for today's show came from Laura Kelly's wonderful book, The Irish in New Orleans. Dr. Kelly's work is comprehensive and sets straight some of the incorrect information found online about the Irish in New Orleans. If you want a deep dive into the history of the Irish in New Orleans, I encourage you to check it out. If you're out of town, grab a copy online at Amazon. But if you're in New Orleans, head over to Octavia Books or to the Maple Street Bookstore and pick up a copy in person. Finally, if you ever want to go down the rabbit hole in 19th century New Orleans, take a look at the Robinson Atlas. I'll post a link on the website in the show notes. The Robinson Atlas reveals a lot about New Orleans at that point in time. It was published in 1883, but contains a series of 30 maps most likely put together in the 1870s. The level of detail and the insights into the city are fascinating. For instance, one thing that is revealed through the Atlas are the number of lumber yards along the New Basin Canal. This is instructive because out by the lake was a large grove of Louisiana bald cypress. The cypress harvested along the canal was used to build many of the Garden District and Uptown homes you see today. Anyway, check it out sometime. Well, that's it. Thanks so much for listening. If you want to hear more shows like this one, please subscribe on iTunes or on Stitcher. New episodes are available every other Wednesday, and you can find us at www.beyondbourbonst.com. Until next time, laissez le bon temps rouler.
Thanks for listening to the Beyond Bourbon Street podcast. Find us anytime at beyondbourbonst.com.